certainly don't have any more time for that. Let's do something productive. Anyone going to be freaked by the fact that these positions have switched since last time? I'm not going to mess with it right now. I think this is where we left off, isn't it? We were talking about this cartoon on slide 6. And I pretty well covered it, so I'm not going to say anything more about that. Slide 7 shows you another cartoon that tries to point out the difference between compartments that the body is divided into. So there's a layer of protective cells, you know, that defines your outer boundary, your skin, your integument, that include, and there are also a layer of exchange cells. Exchange cells are an interface with the external environment through which exchange of some sort can take place, exchange of materials. For instance, your lungs are an exchange surface. It's where you exchange oxygen, carbon dioxide, and water between you and the environment. The intracellular fluid of the cells of the body, the trillions of cells, are their own compartment. Intracellular fluid, or cytosol, is an aqueous solution. And that's important because all of your metabolism, which is you, you are metabolism, all of those chemical reactions have to take place in an aqueous solution, a solution in which water is the solvent. Well, there's also aqueous solution in all of the cells of the boundary between you and the rest of the world. And then there's this gray area in between, which is called extracellular fluid, because extra means outside of. That's another aqueous solution, but it's not contained in any cell. All right, it's within your skin. I mean, it's inside of your body, but it's outside of your body's cells. That's why it's called extracellular fluid. Another word for that is what? Anyone know? Interstitial fluid, right. The interstices are the spaces between things, so that's why it's called interstitial fluid. And that's another aqueous solution. So you have different compartments, all of which, though, are aqueous solutions, importantly for the chemistry that has to take place for life. I mentioned last time that we were open systems, and the only way that we can maintain homeostasis being open systems is if there is continual exchange. Well, this slide is another overview of homeostasis. Changes can be internal changes or external changes. Now, any change that takes place, of course, is going to represent a perturbation or a displacement of some sort of physiological variable like temperature or pH, anything like that. In other words, a change is really an error from the standpoint of the attempt to maintain homeostasis. Ideally, if your goal is to maintain homeostasis, you don't want anything to change. That's impossible, though. Things are changing continuously. So the various physiological variables that we talk about, like temperature and pH, they're never constant. They're never really correct except for single points. The main control system of the body, the nervous system, the brain specifically, has set points for these various variables. And those set points represent the desired value, in a sense, the correct values, correct temperature. temperature, for instance, correct blood pressure. But the actual temperature or the actual blood pressure is rarely right there at where the brain wants it to be. If it's not right where it wants to be, though, that really is an error. An error is a difference between set point and actual measured value. But that doesn't mean that homeostasis doesn't exist, because like I said, homeostasis is not truly staying the same. It's staying within allowable limits. And so when these changes occur, for whatever reason, you know, like for getting cold outside, that would be an external change, it's going to cause some sort of internal change, which is the same thing as an error. Homeostatically, it's an error. That's an error signal. And so to maintain homeostasis, an organism has to do something to try to minimize or negate that error. To negate means to get rid of. And the mechanism by which these errors in physiological variables are negated is negative feedback. All right? There are two types of feedback, fundamentally two types of feedback that occur in organisms. And feedback refers to the fact that some bit of information is fed back into the system, into a previous part of the system. Well, the two kinds of feedback are negative and positive feedback. Negative feedback is called that, though, because the effect of negative feedback is to negate, that's where the negative comes from, negate the error signal. So it's important to realize that negative feedback isn't one direction, meaning I don't want you to think that negative feedback would be what occurs if temperature gets too low, whereas positive feedback occurs when temperature gets too high. That's wrong. Negative feedback is the only kind of feedback that can lead to homeostasis, because it's the only kind of feedback that can reduce the error signal. So the brain keeps track, for instance, of a body temperature. That's the set point that the brain would like the body to be at. If it gets above that, body temperature is too high, the difference between measured and set point is some value other than zero. Zero would mean perfect. You're right at set point. But if it's anything other than zero, whether it's too high or too low, the only way to get it back to zero is to get rid of that error. So it would be negative feedback to bring a high temperature back down, and it would also be negative feedback to bring a low temperature back up. Positive feedback, on the other hand, can never lead to homeostasis, because positive feedback is just the opposite of negative feedback. And in positive feedback, what happens is the error, whichever direction it's in, the error gets even worse. In other words, the variable is forced even farther from set point. And all physiology textbooks that I've ever read give as the classic example of positive feedback labor, process of parturition, giving birth. So what happens there is that when the fetus is about ready to be born, its descent through the uterus stretches the cervix, the neck of the uterus, and that stretching is sensed by stretch receptors. That information is sent back to the brain. The response to that is release of oxytocin, the hormone oxytocin, which travels through the body as a hormone but acts on the uterine muscles, causing them to contract. That contraction of the uterine muscles squeezes the fetus even farther toward the external world, stretching the cervix even farther, which sends even a stronger signal back to the brain, which releases more oxytocin, which causes the uterus to contract even more. And so it's a vicious cycle. It keeps building. Now the important thing about, well, two important things about positive feedback mechanisms. to other important things beyond what I've said. Go ahead.
So is the service spreading like the bird now, that's a negative feedback?
No, that's positive feedback. And that is not something that's leading to homeostasis. It's making things worse, in a sense. But the two additionally important things about positive feedback are that, what was I going to say? Oh, their most positive feedback mechanisms are pathological, meaning they're bad for you. And that goes hand in hand with saying that they can never lead to homeostasis. The ones that are healthy or normal, like childbirth, have to be temporary. All positive feedback mechanisms, whether they're good for you or bad for you, have to be temporary just because they are getting you away from homeostasis. So if it's an unhealthy positive feedback mechanism, either some sort of intervention has to be done to stop it, or you die, and if you die, of course, it's a temporary mechanism, it only lasts until you're dead. If it's a healthy one like childbirth, it's temporary because it only lasts so long, and when it's done, it's replaced by a normal negative feedback mechanism. So the parturition one only lasts the short time it takes to have a baby, from my perspective. Well, I said that they can be most of them are pathological is one thing, and that whether they're pathological or not, they have to be temporary. All right, so slide 9 is a nice simple flow chart describing what a control system is. A controller is something that operates via negative feedback in order to control some variable. But the only way that a controller can work is if it knows what's going on. So there has to be some sort of input signal. There has to be a way to sense what is going on, to measure what the real variable is. The controller then uses that information or integrates it and causes something to happen. That something to happen is the output signal. And in negative feedback, that the appropriate output signal is whatever needs to be done to undo the input signal in order to get it back to the desired set point. I didn't think I included this slide, slide 10. It just shows you a couple kinds of charts that are used in the book, so I'm not going to mention anything more about that. The only reason I included slide 11, which is just a generic graph, is to make sure you know, if you don't already, that any scientific graph shows an ordinate versus an abscissa. The ordinate is the y-axis. The abscissa is the x-axis. So it's always y-axis versus x-axis. By that, I mean that y, whatever's on the y, is called the dependent variable because it depends on what is on the x-axis. X-axis is the independent variable. So as far as experiments are concerned, the thing that you actually adjust in the experiment, like running something at various temperatures, you set those temperatures. That's the independent variable. What you're interested in is how that change in temperature that you adjust affects certain things. In other words, how those things depend on that temperature. So that's why the y-axis is always the dependent variable. And slide 12 gives you another cartoon of the body. This is just a different way of looking at the various organ systems that we've already looked at. And really the main point here is that there's a lot of interaction. You shouldn't think of organ systems as being real entities. They, you know, we organ systems are just things, just collections of organs that is a convenient way for us to categorize things. It's not that they actually are independent of each other. They can't be, of course. They all interact with each other, and there's a lot of overlap physically and, I mean, anatomically and physiologically. All right, so that's, I finally, half hour into the second lecture, finished what I wanted to finish last time. All right, any questions about this introductory chapter? Notice that we've skipped chapters 2, 3, and 4, meaning that the information in there, while important, is stuff that we are hoping that you remember from 188, or 188 is what you had to take to be in here, right? Yeah, go ahead. Well, homeostasis and equilibrium have some similarities, but homeostasis, like I said last time, is maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment. Equilibrium can refer to a lot of things. Equilibrium just refers to the condition wherein changes are no longer occurring. So, for instance, with diffusion is a process that occurs because of disequilibrium. That disequilibrium is a concentration gradient. As long as a concentration gradient exists, diffusion will continue. Eventually, the concentration will be the same at A as it is in B. When that happens, that is the condition of equilibrium. Any other questions from this, from that first chapter? Okay, so the stuff, the background information in 2 through 4, you need to be familiar with, because I'm going to just assume it. So definitely look at those chapters and make sure that you're still up to speed with those topics. This is chapter 5, though, that we're starting right now. This is slide 1 is a cartoon that tries to illustrate mass balance. So in order for there to be mass balance, in order to maintain a constant level in this vat, since it's leaking, the only way to do that is to continuously add water at the same rate that it's being lost. That's a pretty simple notion. And this is, harkens back to the fact that we are open systems. We're always exchanging materials. So to keep things steady inside us, there has to be just as much input as there is output. And so the law of mass balance is shown in slide 2 again. Metabolic production refers to any molecules that result because of metabolism. For instance, we drink water, certainly, but we also make our own water as a chemical byproduct of cellular metabolism. You know, the whole glucose plus O2 becomes, what's on the right-hand side of that, by the way? CO2, water, and energy. Right, that's the whole reason that we eat, is so that we can get energy from the bonds of the molecules that make up the food we eat, but that's a combustion process that produces water. So H2O is taken into the body through intestines and stomach, but it's also produced within our cells. So both of those additions are taken into account. We also continuously lose water. So mass balance, I don't think, is very difficult to understand. Slide 3 breaks down these compartments again. This is a different way of looking at things. So on the left part of this slide, the compartments are initially initialize PIC, you see that those are plasma, interstitial fluid, and intracellular fluid. Now, last time I said blood, just because it was easier to talk about it that way. Technically speaking, it should be plasma. Blood, whole blood, includes... Well, whole blood is a connective tissue. And connective tissues, no matter what kind of connective tissue they are, include a cellular component and an extracellular matrix. The cellular component of whole blood are the blood cells themselves, the erythrocytes and the leukocytes, the red blood cells and white blood cells. They're not part of this extracellular fluid. ECF is extracellular fluid, but you can see that's broken down into plasma and interstitial fluid. Well, what's left over when you spin down whole blood and get rid of just the cells is plasma. None of that is inside of cells. That's all extracellular fluid. But it's its own special part of extracellular fluid because it's still contained within the closed vascular system. All right? So it's kept separate from the rest of the extracellular fluid, which is interstitial fluid. That's the fluid that bathes all of the rest of the cells of the body. It occurs between all the rest of the cells. But you can see that both of those are outside of all cells. So that's what qualifies both plasma and interstitial fluid as extracellular. Intracellular fluid, pretty straightforward. It's all of it's the sum of all the cytosol of all your trillions of cells. Now, part B of this slide talks about the distribution of solutes. There's this of course isn't an exhaustive list. There's a whole lot of solutes, but these are some important ones. Sodium ions, which in case you don't know are Na. Why is it Na, by the way? Natrium, good, good. And why is potassium K? Stands for kalium. Cl's easier to understand, that's chloride ions. And then, what is HCO3, anyone know? Bicarbonate ions, right. These are really big players for various reasons that we'll be talking about. And then there are also proteins. Proteins occur everywhere. But proteins within cells fold up in certain ways that tends to make their exterior negative, partially negative. They're not truly ions, but they act the same way as ions because they have partial charges. So anything with a charge that's in solution is important for reasons of membrane potential that we're going to be talking more about. All right? So now I can finally get to the main topic of this chapter, which is membrane transport. Now, what membranes am I talking about? Because there's different ways of talking about membranes within biology. There's a macroscopic meaning to membrane. There's also a microscopic membrane meaning. The macroscopic means there are membranes that we talk about that are made up of millions of cells. You know, like our skin. The skin is a membrane. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the membrane that encloses all of your individual cells. And in fact, every cell that's ever existed. And those are plasma membranes, or as some books call them, cell membranes. All right, now, have you studied the plasma membrane in detail? What's the principal component of the plasma membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer. Good. Phospholipid bilayer the bilayer part of that phrase means that it's two layers. It's two layers of phospholipids. All right? What are phospholipids? They are molecules that are partly phosphate and partly lipid. That's really important. That's the whole reason you exist. Because phospholipids are examples of molecules that are said to be amphipathic. Is this word familiar? Focus. amphipathic mean? What does amphi mean? It means both or dual. What's another word that has amphi in it? Amphibian. And in the amphibian word, the bi is the same bi as in biology, which means life. So an amphibian has a dual life, or it has both lifestyles. It lives part of its life in water and part on land. The pathic part of amphipathic refers to feeling or preference. So amphipathic has dual preference, and that describes a molecule that is partially polar and partially nonpolar. All right? That's important because polar molecules have no problem being around other polar molecules. Water is an example of a polar molecule. There's an unequal distribution of electrostatic charge. Nonpolar molecules have no problem being around other nonpolar molecules. Lipids are nonpolar. A phospholipid is amphipathic because it has a polar phosphate head and a couple of nonpolar lipid tails. So when they line up in a phospholipid bilayer, they naturally assemble themselves. This is four different phospholipids. These are the lipid tails. These are nonpolar. These are the polar heads. They do that in such a way that forms a continuous membrane. That membrane separates two different aqueous solutions. This is intracellular fluid. This is extracellular fluid. Both of them are aqueous, meaning that they're principally water. Water, I just told you, is polar. So it has no problem being, this intracellular fluid has no problem being around this polar interior surface of the phospholipid bilayer. This extracellular fluid's water has no problem being around this polar exterior surface of the phospholipid bilayer. The inner thickness of the plasma membrane itself is polar. Water doesn't really want to be there. But lipids have no problem being there. Okay? So the things that can pass right through plasma membranes and either enter a cell or exit a cell through the directly through the phospholipid bilayer are nonpolar things, which are lipids principally. Things that don't have charges can go right through there, into or out of the cell. Other things, which includes a lot of important stuff, are excluded from that. But they still have to have a way to get, so they still have to have a way to get through. And they're able to because the cell membrane is not simply phospholipid bilayer. It's a phospholipid bilayer as a foundation, and then it's studded with a bunch of proteins, which we'll be talking about. All right, so what this slide 4 is giving you an overview of, well, the slide 4 is giving you an overview of membrane transport, but notice that you can think of it in two different ways. There are energy requirements and there are physical requirements. This, by the way, is a pain in the ass. What? Now what did I do? Okay. That was easy enough. So there are physical requirements, energy requirements. Physical requirements refers to the fact that we exchange materials. Materials have to come into the cell, certain materials have to leave. So there has to be a way up for actual molecules to get into and out of a cell. Energy requirements has to do with energy. All right. So what this is leading to is the center, the horizontal center of this slide. That's where the membrane transport part comes in. There's a dichotomy energetically with respect to, there's a dichotomy of membrane transport mechanisms with respect to energy requirements. That's why you have white and yellow. So there are membrane transport mechanisms that do not require an input of energy. They happen on their own because of their own internal energy. And those mechanisms are classified as diffusion, but you can see that there's two types of diffusion. simple and facilitated. Those that require energy are called active transport or vesicular transport. Okay, vesicular is spelled thus. Almost always, the source of energy is an ATP molecule, adenosine triphosphate. But notice that there are two active transport mechanisms, primary and secondary, which I'll explain the difference between momentarily. Vesicular transport is its own kind of deal. It's kind of a cheating way of getting something through the plasma membrane without actually putting it through the membrane. It's a cheating way of getting something into or out of a cell without it actually going through the membrane. And we'll look at that in a second. But you see that it uses a membrane-bound vesicle. That's why it's called vesicular. That's just the adjective of vesicle. So let's look at a cartoon of diffusion first. Slide 5 shows presumably a person putting a cube of, let's call it, sugar into a beaker of pure water. When that first happens, you can think of two different spaces. The space taken up by that cube and the space taken up by the surrounding water. Those two spaces differ drastically in sugar concentration. Right? What's concentration? Amount of substance per unit volume. That's why it's units are things like grams per milliliter. All right. Well, there's a really high concentration of sugar in the sugar itself, obviously. It's as high as it can get. At first, at that instant when it's first plopped in there, there's a zero concentration of sugar in the water. So that means that there is a big difference in concentration. And the word for a difference is a gradient, right? If we're talking about a difference in concentration, then we're specifically talking about a concentration gradient. But there are other kinds of gradients, like pressure gradients, for instance, or a gradient of electrical potential energy, which is otherwise called a voltage. Anyway, diffusion requires a gradient. If there's no gradient, meaning no difference in concentration from one place to the other, then there's going to be no diffusion, even though there's going to continuously be movement of molecules. There's always movement of molecules for anything that's above absolute zero, which is everything in the universe. But in diffusion, there is a net movement of materials from where there is a higher concentration to where there's a lower concentration, right? And that's all driven by random movement. So even though it seems like diffusion knows which direction to operate in, it's really only because of random motion. If you get a crowd of people in the middle of a gymnasium and you randomly turn them into, you know, you group them all together right in the middle with no people all around them, and you randomly turn each person into a certain direction, so they're all facing random directions, and you tell them to start walking whichever way they're facing, and if they hit a person, bounce off of them, that represents what molecules are doing. Right? All of their directions are random, just like motion is random. But when you do that, the people that happen to be on the periphery and also happen to be facing outward will be able to walk away from the crowd. They don't bounce off of anything until they hit a wall. So the tendency, even though all of the motion is random, is for there to be a spreading out from that concentrated area to the less concentrated area. That's how diffusion works. And so it comes to equilibrium eventually when every little subspace within that beaker is at the same concentration. In other words, there's no concentration gradient anymore. But there's still a hell of a lot of movement of solute molecules. That sugar is just whizzing around in there. It's just, there's no net movement in one direction. All right, slide 6 gives a nice cartoon of the phospholipid bilayer I just drew you. And What this slide is all about is how certain things affect the rate of diffusion through a membrane. Now, the last slide didn't involve any membranes, and that's true of diffusion. Diffusion doesn't have to occur across a membrane. It can just occur from one subspace to another subspace. But diffusion can occur across a membrane. The only requirements for diffusion to occur is that there needs to be a concentration gradient, and there needs to be a way for that particle to be able to get from one place to the other. So, even if there is a big concentration gradient for a certain particle from outside to inside a cell, in other words, across the membrane, there won't be any diffusion unless there's a way for that particle to get from outside to inside, in other words, to get through the membrane. And that is affected by certain things. So Fick's law here in this box in salmon tells you the principal things that affect rates of diffusion. One is the surface area. The more plasma membrane you have, the more opportunity you have for things to pass through it. That makes sense. One is the concentration gradient itself, meaning the magnitude of the concentration gradient. The steeper a concentration gradient, meaning the bigger the difference in concentrations from one point to another, the faster diffusion will occur. And that's, you know, that's analogous to, if you think about this in terms of a garden hose, you're working with pressure gradients. The more pressure you give at the spigot, the more difference there is between there and the end of the hose. Go ahead.
Just a real quick thing. If anyone in here has an old edition of the book, that equation on the bottom, they have it wrong. They have it reversed. So
they have the numerator and denominator reversed? Yeah, okay.
And so the one we've given you is correct, which is another point. If you ever get to a point when you're reading the book and you simply can't figure out what's going on, it might be that the book is wrong. That's okay. The publisher does do really stupid things once in a while. When that happens, just contact us and we'll clear it up.
And that's a good point to just make sure when you look at things like this that it makes sense to you. Don't just say, well, this is an equation I need to memorize. First of all, it's not an equation. It's a proportionality relation. But make sure this makes sense in your head, okay? All of these things on Fick's law that are in the numerator mathematically make sense in your head, that if any of those things goes up, then diffusion goes up. Because if you make a numerator bigger, the value gets bigger, right? If you make a denominator bigger, the value gets smaller because you're dividing by a bigger number, right? So anything downstairs, which is membrane thickness, is going to reduce the amount of diffusion. Well, that makes sense. The thicker a membrane is, the more a particle is going to be impeded or kept from diffusing through it. It's harder to go through a thick layer than it is a thin layer. Now, membrane permeability is the only thing I didn't mention that's up on the numerator. Membrane permeability just refers to anything that affects how easily a particle is able to go through the membrane. That's what permeability is. To permeate means to go through. All right? So this bottom box shows you that membrane permeability isn't just a simple thing. You can further break down membrane permeability into two components, lipid solubility and molecular size. Lipid solubility is the degree to which that particle is able to dissolve in a lipid. Lipids dissolve well in lipids. Non-lipids don't. That's why non-lipids, water as an example, do not permeate through the membrane very easily, or directly through the phospholipid bilayer, that is. And therefore, the membrane permeability to a polar substance is pretty low, right? Because the numerator in that case would be low. A lipid permeates pretty easily. Molecular size is there. for common sense reasons, hopefully it's common sense, the bigger something is, the harder it is to push it through a membrane, right? So small things and nonpolar things are the most easy particles to diffuse through a plasma membrane, directly through the lipid bilayer, that is. Other things will be able to diffuse still, but they'll need some help from some sort of protein that's embedded in the plasma membrane. Any questions on this? All right. Now, I've included Table 5.1, Slide 7, for you to use as a study aid, but I'm not going to read tables to you. This is stuff I'm talking about anyway. Same with Slide 8. Slide 9 is a rundown of membrane proteins. Now, remember, proteins are one of the four types of macromolecules. Proteins are the things that really do all the work, all the important stuff in a cell, pretty much. Not to say that the other macromolecules aren't necessary. But just about any function you can think of, not every, but just many of them, is performed by some sort of proteins. Well, those occur outside the cell, inside the cell, and that's not what we're talking right now. We're talking about proteins that are actually part of the membrane. So, like I said, the plasma membrane is not just a pure sheet of phospholipid bilayer. It's phospholipid bilayer studded here and there with millions of proteins, and literally millions per one individual cell. So you have millions of trillions of membrane proteins in your body, which is, it's a shitload. So membrane proteins can be categorized, you see here, either structurally or functionally. Structurally just means based on how they're made. Functionally means how they operate. You can have lipid-anchored proteins, integral proteins, peripheral proteins. The difference here is that peripheral proteins are proteins that are just on the edge. That's the periphery is the edge. So they don't extend all the way through the thickness of the membrane. Integral proteins do. Transmembrane proteins, which are types of integral proteins, do. They extend all the way through the thickness. And those are the ones that I really care about right now, because those are the ones that are involved in membrane transport. Transmembrane transport, meaning all the way through the membrane. That should stand to reason, because if a protein is necessary to get something through the thickness, that protein itself better stick all the way through the membrane. Well, on the function side, we have membrane transporters, which are what we're really talking about mostly in this chapter. There are also structural proteins that hold cells together, for instance, but also make up the cytoskeleton, which is a whole scaffolding within the cell itself that does various stuff. There are also membrane-bound enzymes. And what are enzymes? They are catalysts, right. They are biological catalysts. And what is a catalyst? A catalyst is something that reduces the activation energy of a reaction and thereby allows that reaction to occur much more readily than it would occur in the absence of that catalyst. Furthermore, the catalyst doesn't take direct part in that reaction, so it's not used up. A catalyst can be reused. Now that's really important for biology, because the thousands of chemical reactions that make up your metabolism could occur without catalysts, but it might take 1,000 years or so for it to happen once. That's not really tenable for life. So you exist because because proteins act as catalysts to allow these thousands of metabolic reactions to occur readily and in under situations that are amenable to life. I'll just say it that way. And then there are membrane receptors. These membrane receptors are proteins that are part of the membrane and that act as receptors. What is a receptor? It's a protein that has a certain place on itself called the receptor site that is shaped in a particular way that allows for the binding of a specific kind of particle that also has the correct shape. And what's the general name for a particle that can bind to a receptor site? A ligand. Okay, good. These are all important things, but the main focus for this chapter are these membrane transporters. So there are two classes of those, carrier proteins and channel proteins. The difference is that channel proteins form just basically an open channel. They're kind of like a bead. A bead has a lumen. The lumen of anything is the open plate, right? So the lumen of a bead would be where the string goes through. Certain proteins called channel proteins make a little hole in the membrane. And so anything that can get through that lumen is able to go into or out of the cell without actually having to go through that phospholipid bilayer. All right, so that's important for things that are polar, for instance. Other proteins are called carrier proteins. They don't actually form an open channel. They operate on the basis of conformational changes. Now, what do I mean by conformation? Right, it's just a name for the shape of a protein. Proteins operate, no matter what their capacity is, all of these things I'm talking about, operate based on their shape. And that's why proteins are able to have such a diverse set of functions, because proteins can have just about any shape you can think of, because they're polymers of amino acids. But anyway, whenever there is a binding of a ligand to a receptor protein, that binding event causes a conformational change, a change in the shape of the protein. And in the case of a carrier protein, that conformational change is such that the ligand is dragged from one side of the membrane to the other, basically. So it's a way of getting into or out of the cell without there actually having to be a little hole in the membrane. It's not a continuously open channel. All right, now speaking of continuously open channels, there are such things, and those are called open channels or non-gated channels, but there are also channels that would be open were it not for the existence of a gate on one or both ends of the tunnel. If that gate's closed, nothing gets through it, of course, but certain conditions can open that gate. So there are gated channels, and as you see here, there are three kinds of gated channels, depending on what it is that acts as the key to open that gate. There are mechanically gated channels that open up in response to mechanical stress, for instance, being pushed on from some external force. There are voltage-gated channels, which open up in response to a certain transmembrane potential, or just simply membrane potential. All right, and that means a difference in charge between the inside and outside surface of the membrane itself. Those are really important for your nervous system and muscular system. And there are chemically gated channels, which some books call ligand gated channels, that open up based on whether a ligand is bound to another part of that same protein that's acting as the channel. All right? So Figure 10 just shows you a general view of a ligand, some general ligand binding to a membrane-bound receptor protein. The blue part of the cell membrane is the phospholipid bilayer. That salmon thing is the receptor protein. It has the right shape or conformation to accept a certain ligand. That's important. Receptors have specificity, meaning that only one or a very few kinds of particles are able to bind to them and therefore able to cause whatever change occurs when that binding event occurs. But if it is the right kind of ligand and the receptor is there, when that binding occurs, a conformational change occurs that can have some sort of effect in the cell because of the change in shape of the protein. That's just the general scheme. Let's look at a closer up view of membrane transporters, figure 11. On the left part, you have channel proteins. And channel proteins are just as I described. They actually form little holes in the membrane. This is a cross-section of it through the protein. So there's a little water-filled channel through which things can move. But even though it seems like it's non-discriminate, channel proteins still have specificity. So even though, even ones that are always open, just open channels, you still have to be the right shaped or sized thing to get through those open channels. All right, so there are, for instance, non-gated potassium ion channels. They're always open, but even though they're always open, the only thing that goes through them are potassium ions. Specificity. The gated channels are shown in the lower left. That's self-explanatory. But the carrier proteins on the right, notice that they are not really operating as channels. They operate by virtue of changing shape. And when that shape change occurs, certain things only are able to go through them. Now, the reason that they have specificity is even more straightforward. Carrier proteins have specificity because carrier proteins don't operate unless something binds to them. And nothing binds to them unless they're the right shape themselves. So the ligand has to be correctly shaped for a carrier protein. Now, there are three functional classifications of carrier proteins. You have uniport carriers. Uniport, uni meaning one, port coming from transport. Uniport are carriers are ones that simply move one thing at a time, one kind of particle, that is, glucose in this example. Symport carriers get their name because sim means share. Symporters or symport carriers move two different things, but they move them in the same direction. Whereas antiporters also carry two things, but in opposite directions. Anti meaning opposite or against. Notice that both symporters and antiporters are co-transporters. Co-transporters is just a more generic term, meaning it transports two different things. All right. Figure 12 gives you a little analogy for how some of these proteins work. If you have a gated protein, it's similar to the situation in which the boat doesn't get to go through this strait from one open sea to the other open sea, right? Similarly with a molecule trying to get through the plasma membrane. But what you see here is that it has to have the right shape in order to fit into the receptor site of the protein itself. Because it's not until that binding occurs that the carrier protein changes shape, right? And that's because of conformational change. Okay, slide 13 is an illustration of a special kind of diffusion, facilitated diffusion, as you see here. And that is a special kind of diffusion compared to simple diffusion, because it requires the help or the facilitation of some sort of membrane protein. Simple diffusion would occur for a lipid, for instance. If there is a concentration gradient, let's say that there's more of lipid A outside the cell than there is inside the cell, and if it's a small lipid, then it can easily get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. And since there is a gradient, it's naturally going to diffuse under its own energy. The energy is the gradient itself. Okay? That gradient represents an energy source. So that'll happen on its own. That's simple diffusion. Doesn't doesn't require any external input of energy in the form of ATP. Well, facilitated diffusion doesn't either, because facilitated diffusion, as the phrase implies, is diffusion. But facilitated diffusion doesn't occur unless there is something there to allow that diffusing particle to get into or out of the cell. And that's simply because it can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. So glucose is a good example of this. When there, after a meal, there is when you finally are done digesting the meal and you're now absorbing the nutrients from that meal, the major nutrient is glucose, which is being broadcast through your body in the plasma. Plasma, remember, is extracellular fluid. The cells of the body require that glucose to make their own ATP, ultimately. That glucose can't just go directly through the plasma membrane. So there have to be transport proteins that allow for glucose to diffuse into the cell. It's diffusion because it's gradient driven, but it's facilitated because those proteins are required. Now, if you think about what would happen, after a while, the concentration inside the cell would become equal to the concentration outside the cell, and then diffusion would stop, right? There would still be glucose going through the membrane, but there would be just as much going into as there is going out. So there would be no net diffusion. Well, a cell gets away from that problem by this conversion step, which is shown in C. So as glucose comes into a cell, it is phosphorylated. To phosphorylate something is to add a phosphate to it. Phosphates are part of ATP. That's why it's adenosine triphosphate. An ATP molecule has three phosphates attached to it. Right? It's an adenosine molecule with three phosphates attached to it. That ATP can donate one of its phosphates to some other molecule, in this case glucose. When that happens, that phosphorylation of glucose means you no longer just simply have glucose. You now have G6P, glucose 6-phosphate, glycerol, oh, I forget what that stands for, glyceraldehyde 6-phosphate, whatever. It's no longer just glucose. And therefore, it is not contributing to the glucose concentration inside the cell. In other words, by converting glucose once the glucose is inside the cell, you're maintaining a strong gradient to bring more and more glucose into the cell. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Anyway, that's facilitated diffusion. Now, active transporters do require energy. And almost always that energy comes in the form of ATP, which is why if you look at the names of some important active transporters, this isn't an exhaustive list, but parts of the names is ATPase. ATP, self-explanatory. What does the ASE indicate? It's an enzyme, right? Enzyme names end in ASE. And so ATPase is an enzyme that breaks that terminal phosphate bond of ATP and allows that energy to be used for something. So a sodium-potassium pump, or a sodium-potassium exchange pump, as some books call it, or sodium-potassium ATPase, is, I don't want to rank these as important, they're all vital, but the sodium-potassium exchange pump is the most prevalent of the primary active transporters. All of your body's cells have these transporters continuously working. And in fact, about 40% of your energy budget, about 40% of the energy that you get from the food that you eat throughout your lifetime, goes just to running these quadrillions of sodium-potassium exchange pumps. And that's important because that's what maintains a difference with respect to the concentration of these two particles outside the cell and inside the cell. And what I mean by that is that the sodium-potassium exchange pump continuously transports potassium ions into the cell and sodium ions out of the cell. By doing that, extracellular fluid is always richer in sodium ions, has a higher sodium ion concentration. Intracellular fluid always has a higher potassium ion concentration. All right? And the reason that's important is for something I can't explain in 1 minute that I have left. But that's an important pump. Another thing I want to say about pumps, though, is all of these active transporters are called pumps because pumps in the macroscopic sense, like a water pump, those all require energy because they're trying to move something in the opposite direction that it would like to go on its own. Water pumps pump things uphill. Water spills downhill. It doesn't spill uphill. You have to put energy into it to get it uphill. And so all active transporters, or pumps, move things against their concentration gradient. That's why it requires energy, because the diffusion wants to move them along their gradient, not against them.